book of Leviticus in your Bibles and the third chapter. Leviticus chapter 3 in your Bibles. I hope you've been able to persevere in reading a chapter each day through the week. When you get into the offerings of Leviticus, it's sometimes difficult, as it was with the descriptions of the tabernacle at the end of the book of Exodus. These are matters which we are not familiar with by sight, and it becomes a little more difficult to read and appreciate all the details that are being worked out. There is much overlap, as you might expect, as we unfold offering after offering after offering in these opening chapters of Exodus. So we're just going to be highlighting some of the key points and some of the differences in these various offerings. And all the offerings will come to their focal point and climax in Jesus Christ. So while there are different aspects of sin and Israel's relationship with God being emphasized in each different offering, all of them find their realization in Jesus Christ. Leviticus chapter 1 talked about the burnt offering. Chapter 2 talked about the grain offering. Chapter 3 talks about the peace offerings. And the peace offering was a voluntary offering. By that we mean a man could bring a peace offering when he wanted to bring one. It wasn't on a prescribed schedule, but it's what is called a voluntary offering. When we get into chapter 7, we'll see that there are three special reasons why a person could bring a peace offering. It could be an expression of thanksgiving to God, perhaps when either before or after an event. You could be seeking deliverance or victory in an area, perhaps over an enemy. So in anticipation of that, you would bring a peace offering, which is an expression of thanks in that category for the help that God would give you in that coming conflict. Or you could bring that after he had given the victory, and it would be an expression of thanks for the victory he had given. So a peace offering can be a thank offering in the context of conflict and victory with an enemy. It could be a vow offering offered in the context of a vow. When you had made a vow and fulfilled or completed that vow, then you would offer a peace offering to God. Or it could just be a free will offering. You would offer a peace offering when you just wanted to express to God your thanks and appreciation to Him for all His goodness and all His blessing. So this is a very attractive offering, if we could put it that way, where Israel has a chance to express out of their heart appreciation to God and thanks to Him for what He's done. This offering is unique because it's the only offering that allowed the worshiper to eat part of what was sacrificed. And we'll see that as we move along. But part of this offering will be burnt on the altar. Part of it will be given to the priest and consumed by them. And the rest will be kept by the offerer or returned to him and will form a portion that is his, and he will have a meal following this offering. So it becomes a time of fellowship. The family of the individual doing the offering would be invited to this feast. Friends could come. So it's sometimes called a fellowship offering because it's an expression of our relationship with God, our fellowship with Him, and our fellowship with others who are worshipers of Him. Because if I was going to offer a peace offering, I would invite my family and others to come and partake of that sacrifice with me. And it would be a time of fellowship and enjoying our relationship with God together. That'll be talked a little bit about a little bit fuller in chapter 7 of Leviticus. This offering, we'll see also, was usually offered in the context of a burnt offering. Burnt offering becomes the major sacrifice for the Israelite. That was one that went on daily in the sacrificial routine of Israel. And here the peace offering was often offered following the burnt offering. Chapter 3 opens up. Now, if this offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings, if he is going to offer out of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without defect before the Lord. So this offering could be from his herd, the cattle, the sheep, the goats, just as it was in the burnt offering. However, in the burnt offering, it had to be a male animal that was sacrificed. Here it can be a male or female animal that is sacrificed, which indicates this offering is less significant than the burnt offering. The requirement in the animal sacrifice is not as high. There is more breadth allowed, and the female animals are permissible here. When he calls it a peace offering, the word peace offering probably comes from the Hebrew word shalom that we're familiar with. Some of the ideas in that word are wholeness, completeness, harmoniousness, well-being. I believe one commentator called this the offering of well-being. And that's the idea being expressed here, the wholeness, the harmoniousness, the fellowship in expressing thanks to God. The same procedure in verse 2, he shall lay his hand on the head of his offering, slay it at the doorway of the tent, and the blood is sprinkled. It's never said in chapter 3 that this makes atonement, this offering. But what is described here of putting the hand on the head of the animal, it's sacrificing, the blood being sprinkled would indicate that atonement is taking place. In verse 3, the sacrifice of the peace offerings, he shall present offerings by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. The fat was thought to represent the choice portion of the animal. And as such, it belonged to God. You have to keep that in your mind as we move through several of these offerings, and God requires the fat to be given to him. You have to put yourself in that framework. This was viewed as the choice portion. And as such, it had to be offered to God. What God is saying is, I take the choice portions for myself. They must be offered to me. Some would see here, when you see the kidneys and the entrails being offered, in the Old Testament, this is where the seat of the emotions are placed. The kidneys, the entrails. We would talk about our heart being the seat of our emotions. Well, there they would talk about your kidneys, your bowels, the entrails. And because of that, some see the requirement here of offering the kidneys and the entrails as an expression of offering my deepest emotions to God. From within my very being, I want to offer to God what I am, my strongest feelings, my strongest expressions of love, my deepest feelings I'm presenting before him. And that may well be why these are the particular parts of the animal that are required. In verse 5, Aaron's son shall offer it up in smoke on the altar on the burnt offering, which means that it will be offered immediately following the burnt offering. There are several examples we won't take time to turn to in the Old Testament where you find the peace offering offered immediately following the burnt offering. So as mentioned when we started this chapter, usually the peace offering is given following the burnt offering. So they're closely joined together, the burnt offering being the main sacrifice. And then following that, they would offer the peace offering. In verse 9, from the sacrifice of peace offerings, he shall bring as an offering by fire of the Lord its fat, the entire fat tail, which he shall remove close to the backbone. The fat that covers the entrails, the fat that is on the entrails, the kidney, the liver. This repetition sort of makes it difficult just to sit down and read through these portions. The fat tail, that has to be offered too. It was a greatly prized portion of the animal. One I would not find hard to give up, but then I'm not an Israelite living 1,500 years before Christ. It was the prized portion, the fat tail, and so it belonged to God. Got to get a point here that God expects a willingness on the part of those who worship Him to give Him the best. What would have been viewed as the best is what He expects from them. So here, the choice fat tail. Give it to the Lord and don't fudge on it. Cut it off close to the backbone. Verse 17. Jump down to verse 17. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwellings. You shall not eat any fat or any blood. Continual prohibition throughout the Mosaic Law. And during the entire time when the Mosaic Law was in effect, you could not eat the fat, because that's determined as belonging to the Lord. And you could not eat the blood. Leviticus chapter 17 and verse 11 says, "The life of the flesh is in the blood. I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls." Since the life was viewed as in the blood, the life was God given, the life belonged to God. And no one could take that life to himself or take authority over that life. So you could not consume the blood. And when we talk about eating the blood, as we'll see, what they'll be talking about is not draining the meat properly. Not the idea of sitting down with a glass of blood, but not properly draining the blood from the meat. Now, that had to be done because the blood belonged to God, because the life had come from God, and the life must be returned to God. That's the peace offering. Chapter 4 is the sin offering. And these are offerings, the sin offerings, are offerings that dealt with unintentional sin. When you sinned unintentionally, this is the sacrifice that you would bring. It's a sacrifice, again, that's offered less often than the burnt offering. Less valuable animals are offered than in the burnt offering. So we're constantly reminded that the burnt offering of chapter 1 is the focal offering for the Israelites. There'll be variation in this sacrifice. The animal to be sacrificed and the place where the blood is sprinkled from that animal depends upon the social status of the one doing the offering. Be different for the high priest than it will be for the common person. So through this chapter, there is a development of the various groups involved. Verse 2, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and commits any of them," then he goes on, "if the anointed priest," starting out then with the priest, "is the one who does it." When he sins, uses the word sins means to miss the mark. We're familiar with that. They fail to do what God says they ought to do. They miss the standard that God has established. Unintentionally, the key idea here in verse 2 that we need to understand, because there are going to be some sins covered that were done willfully. People knew what they were doing. But the contrast with an unintentional sin is a defiant or high-handed sin. Turn over to Numbers chapter 15. Numbers and the 15th chapter. And while you're turning there, can we turn these bright spots down a little bit right here in the front? I can't see anybody out there tonight. And I wouldn't want you to leave and I'd still be here talking. Because I've really been through this material myself. Got an awful bright light on the inside light here on each one. If you could turn that down, that would be a great help. If you can't, ushers, just stand at the door and don't let anybody go, and I'll preach by faith. Numbers 15, verse 22. Now I can't see the page because I looked at the lights. All these little black dots running all over my Bible. All right. It's coming back. Don't go anywhere. All right, Numbers 15:22. But when you unwittingly fail and do not observe all these commandments which the Lord has spoken to Moses, even all that the Lord has commanded you through Moses, even from the day when the Lord gave commandment and onward throughout your generations, then it shall be, if it is done unintentionally, then this is what is to be done. Now come on down to verse 30. Verse 29, you shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is a native, the alien. But, verse 30, the person who does anything defiantly. So that's the contrast. Unintentional and defiant. The word defiantly means with a high hand. Someone who sins defiantly sins high-handedly. That involves deliberate, overt acts of rebellion in challenge to God. For those sins, there are no offerings. That person has to be executed. So we're told he shall be cut off from among these people because, verse 31, he has despised the word of the Lord. He'll be completely cut off. His guilt will be upon him. So that's the contrast back in Leviticus when we're talking about unintentional. The contrast in that is with high-handed, defiant sins. So unintentional would include all sins that aren't done with an attitude of open rebellion and defiance against God. So a little broader than we might think of unintentional. A person here might willfully sin, but it's not done with that attitude of setting up a challenge against God and demonstrating that he can disobey God. That's the kind of sins we're talking about. Back Leviticus chapter 4. Then the sin offerings cover the unintentional realm. And there is not the provision for the other kind in Israel. The first group dealt with, or the first individual, is the anointed priest in verse 3. If the anointed priest sins so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Lord a bull without defect as a sin offering for the sin he has committed. The anointed priest is probably a reference here to the high priest. Now, all the priests will be anointed, that's true. But the high priest is anointed in a special way as the leader of the people of God. And so in that position, his sin as high priest affects the whole nation. And most serious is when the spiritual leader of the nation would sin. He had to bring a bull for sacrifice. This is the largest animal required for a sin offering. It would indicate the magnitude of responsibility that rests on the priest when he sins. Jump down to verse 6. After they've slain the animal, the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. We have gone in to the tent of meeting. Remember, you come in through the opening of that outer court of the tabernacle. And there you confront the brazen altar where the sacrifice occurs. But now when an anointed priest has sinned and the sacrifice is made for him, they must take the blood from that sacrifice and take it on into the tent of meeting to the veil that separated the outer part of that tent, the holy place, from the Holy of Holies. And the high priest only went into the Holy of Holies once a year to offer sacrifice on behalf of the people. But before that veil, they had to sprinkle the blood then 7 times. Oh, you see that there has been a step here to indicate the seriousness of the sin of the high priest. Verse 7, the priest also shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense, which is before the Lord in the tent of meeting. So in that area too within the tent of meeting, we might call the holy place, where the altar of incense is, blood had to be applied to that altar when we are atoning for the sin of the high priest. Down to verse 12. The rest of the bull. Verse 11. The hide of the bull, its flesh with its head, its legs, its entrails, its refuse, all the rest of the bull that hasn't been offered up on the burnt on the altar of burnt offering. They're to bring out to a clean place outside the camp where the ashes are poured out and burn it on wood with fire where the ashes are poured out. It shall be burned. And the picture here is the defilement that has been caused by the sin of the high priest is removed from the camp of the people. So you take that animal out to an area that is not defiled, a clean place, and it is consumed there. It's not consumed on the altar as part of the sacrifice, this portion, the remainder of the animal. But it's taken outside the camp, removing the defilement. Remember in the book of Hebrews, we're told that Christ has suffered outside the camp. Again, that's drawing from this sacrifice. And he has removed the defilement from himself, from his people. Here the priest is doing it for himself. And from the people, because his sin brought defilement on the nation. And so that cleansing must take place. Verses 13 to 21 talk about the whole congregation. And that may refer to the nation as a whole, a national sin, or it may refer to the leaders of the nation. Both are possible in the expression here. The whole congregation of Israel commits an error. That could be the whole nation has been joined together in an area of disobedience, or it could be referring to the leaders, which would encompass the nation by virtue of their leadership. Same procedure here. A bull had to be sacrificed. Jump down to verse 22. We won't go through the details because the details are basically the same in what is followed through. A leader sins. Here, a particular leader, perhaps a tribal leader, a leader of one of the tribes in Israel. Maybe the one in view. Verse 23. If his sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring for his offering a goat, a male without defect. There's a significant difference in the animal required here. For the whole congregation or for the high priest, it was a bull. But now it is a male goat without defect. In verse 25, the priest is to take some of the blood of the offering with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering. So again, here the blood is applied at the brazen altar, the altar of burnt offering in the outer court. It must not be carried in and applied in where the altar of incense is or where the veil is. Oh, God recognizing and making a distinction between the people, which would fit the emphasis of Scripture in the New Testament as well as the Old. Greater responsibility is given, and so there's greater accountability. And that is what is happening here. The high priest, the leaders of the people, they have a greater accountability before God, and they are held responsible for their sin. Their sin has a greater impact before God on the nation. The common people are mentioned down in verse 27. Down through, really, the rest of the chapter. The common people, verse 27, one of the common people, literally, the people of the land. They don't have to bring as valuable a sacrifice as the priests or the rulers. They could bring a female goat or lamb. The lamb is mentioned down in verse 32. A female lamb, a female goat could be brought by the common people. Again, their requirement is a little bit lower. The sin offering provided forgiveness, and it provided for purification from the defilement that sin brings. So there is the forgiveness of sins, but then there is the reminder that the defilement caused by sin must be cleansed and removed from the nation. God is a holy God. He's going to dwell among his people. So his people must be holy and undefiled. We see that principle carried over to the New Testament, do we not? What? Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? Therefore, glorify God in your body. See, the principle is there. God is going to dwell among his people must be undefiled and holy. Israel as a nation and the camp of the nation was the center of the dwelling place of God. So all defilement had to be removed. Now he dwells within us. Principle is still there. All defilement must be removed. We must be a holy people before him. Of course, it's the death of Christ that provides that cleansing today for us as God's children. When you come into chapter 5, the first 13 verses continue the discussion of the sin offerings. So the chapter break doesn't follow the offerings like it did in the early part of the chapter. So the first 13 verses of chapter 5 are still talking about the sin offerings. And in the first four verses, he'll talk about sins of omission. In other words, what a person failed to do that they should have done. So not an overt act of sin, but sinning by failure to do what you should have done. Refers to the fact his sin is hidden from him. Down in verse 3, if he touches human uncleanness of whatever sort his uncleanness may be with which he becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him. Indicates he's probably forgotten he did it. Perhaps he touched a dead body or something that had been defiled. And it slipped his mind. He just forgot. It was hidden from him. He forgot to go through the ritual cleansing to be pure and so on. Well, this is covered here then. When he's convicted by his conscience, all of a sudden it dawns on him, I was defiled. And I failed to do what I should have done. Then he can bring the sin offering. Verse 6, he shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord. And here guilt or trespass offerings and sin offerings are closely related. We're going to talk about the guilt offerings next. They'll pick up in verse 14 of chapter 5. But you see how the offerings become very closely associated with one another? So that you offer peace offering right after you've offered a burnt offering, and here you're going to offer a guilt offering when you've offered a sin offering. And there is a blending and an overlapping. It's not a clear-cut distinction. This offering, and there's the line drawn. This offering, there the line's drawn. But there is an overlapping seen in this various offerings. Verses 11 to 13 are an interesting aspect of the offerings. We had the grain offering in chapter 2 of Leviticus. And there was not, atonement was not the issue. No blood was shed. Here, the sin offerings are in the context of atonement. They're offered for forgiveness and they're offered for purification. But here is a provision for people who are too poor to offer a blood sacrifice. They can bring an offering of fine flour. Verse 11, but if his means are insufficient for two turtle doves, two young pigeons, then for his offering for that which he has sinned, he shall bring the tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering. Interesting there. We would not expect that God would accept anything but a blood offering for a sin offering. And yet here, God says, where a person cannot afford even the small animal to offer, the flour will be accepted as a symbolic replacement of the blood. And that will be accepted as his sin offering. Keep your finger there and jump back to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews 9 makes note of this exception. Hebrews chapter 9. And verse 22. And according to the law, one may almost say all things are cleansed by blood. You know that? One may almost say all things are cleansed by blood. Can't say you that all things are cleansed by blood. You can say almost all things. You know why? There was a provision in Leviticus chapter 5, verses 11 to 13, for cleansing through the offering of grain for those too poor to make a blood sacrifice. So one may almost say all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no forgiveness. But there was provision even for sin offering. Now, there would be a broader covering to the burnt offerings, and then in the Day of Atonement, that would provide a blood sacrifice for the nation as a nation and everybody in the nation. But here you ought to note that there is a provision. What this does is demonstrate God's mercy in generously making provision for everyone so that there is no excuse. I cannot say, I couldn't bring what was required. God does not require what he does not enable us to do. And everyone would be able to bring the fine flour, even if that's the most they could do. With verse 14 of chapter 5, we come to the trespass offering. And this can also be called the guilt offering. And so it depends on the Bible you're using. Some will call it a guilt offering. Some will call it a trespass offering. This is an offering that is given when a person has become guilty by virtue of trespassing against holy things. Or when he is sworn deceitfully. He swore deceitfully without an intention to follow through. Or he violated holy things. And we'll see what they might be as we move through. Verse 15, it had to be a ram or a male lamb for this offering. So this shows that this is a very important and significant sacrifice. It's one of the most narrow as far as the animal allowed. It had to be a male ram or a male lamb in this particular sacrifice in verse 15. The holy thing, the person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy thing. This might include eating a portion of the sacrifice that was not allotted to him. Perhaps he ate a portion of the offering that belonged to the Lord, belonged to the priest. Remember, that was called holy. It belonged to the priest. Well, perhaps without thinking, perhaps without paying attention, the offerer ate what belonged to the priest. He's accountable to God for that. Perhaps he made a vow and failed to fulfill that vow. Perhaps he didn't pay one of the tithes responsible for which he was responsible as a member of the nation. All of this would be a violation, a sin against the holy thing for which he would make a trespass offering. Now, in this offering, there's another dimension. Not only do you offer the prescribed animal, but you pay a penalty. The penalty is 120%. You make good what you did, verse 16. He shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and shall add a fifth part to it. So, what you did, you replace it. If you ate of a portion of the meat that was to be given to the priest, you replace that portion, and you also add a fifth, 20% to it. If you failed to pay a tithe, you pay that tithe and you add a fifth again to it. So there's a penalty attached along with a trespass offering that makes restitution as well as makes the sacrifice to atone. When you come to chapter 6, there's going to be a further discussion of the offerings, but the first 7 verses continue the discussion of the guilt offering or the trespass offering. Verse 3, one has found what was lost and lied about it and sworn falsely so that he sins in regard to any one of the things a man may do, then it shall be when he sins and becomes guilty, he shall restore what he took and so on. This is why it's important to keep in mind what we say unintentional sins are. Here's someone sinning intentionally in that sense of the word. He's found what was lost and lied about it. He said, I didn't find it. He swore falsely. No, that's intentional. That's not something he didn't know what he was doing. But it's not in the category of the high-handed, overt, defiant sins of someone taking his stand against God, which required the death penalty. So when we say it's for unintentional sins, You have to see it in that definition. It encompasses what we would call some intentional sins, but not defiant kinds of acts of rebellion. Verse 7, the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven for any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. The trespass offering is significant in the context of Christ's death, because Christ's death atones for the damage and the injury done by our sin. It's an important dimension. That's what the trespass offering does. It's an offering, involves restitution, it involves the payment of a penalty. It atones for any damage, for any injury that may have been suffered as a result of the sin. Turn over to Isaiah 53. That great chapter on the suffering and death of the Messiah in Isaiah 53 calls Christ's death a trespass offering to God, a guilt offering. Isaiah 53, verse 6, all of us like sheep have gone astray, each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shears, he did not open his mouth. That picture there, we are the ones gone astray. We have incurred the guilt. We have caused the damage, if you will. But Christ becomes the lamb that takes our place. Look at verse 10. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief, if he would render himself as a guilt offering. The offering we're talking about. The trespass offering, the guilt offering. Well, that great chapter in Isaiah, you ought to read it with the guilt or trespass offering of Leviticus in the background. His death satisfies a righteous God. God has been the one offended by our sin. The death of Christ satisfies his justice, pays our penalty in full. All my debts have been paid, paid in full. That's the significance of this offering. Christ is the trespass offering. So when I sin, I offended God. I am guilty, in debt. Jesus Christ paid my debt by his death. Back to Leviticus. You pick up with verse 8. What we're going to do now, what is going to be done, is we're going to review the offerings again. Each of the offerings will be gone over, repeating some material, adding some material, but this time the emphasis will be on the priest's role in worship with the offering of the sacrifice. The first time through, the emphasis was on the responsibility of the worshiper, the one who brought the sacrifice. Now the emphasis will be on the role of the priest. And the two things go together. To make a sacrifice, you need a priest. And, of course, the principle will be that Jesus Christ is our high priest in the New Testament, and every single one of us now as believers are believer priests. He's made us a kingdom and priests. Our God. So we can come by virtue of the death of Christ, his sacrifice, offered as our high priest, and present to God the sacrifices that he requires. So this has the dimension of the priest now in view. The strong emphasis in this section on the offerings, on eating of the sacrificial meat, that portion of the sacrifice that the priest was allowed to eat, or in the context of the priest, the peace offering, that the worshiper himself was allowed to eat. The burnt offering is in verses 8 to 13. And we won't go through these again except to point out some significant factors in each one. Leviticus 1 talked about the burnt offering. Now here in verses 8 to 13 of chapter 6, the burnt offering. The stress in this paragraph is on the fact that the fire on the altar of burnt offering must never go out. Note verse 9. This is the law for the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth, on the altar, all night until the morning. The fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. Verse 12. The fire on the altar, it shall be kept burning on it. Verse 13. Fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out. So strong stress, as we talk about the burnt offering again, that the fire for this offering is never to die out. Now that may be to serve as a constant reminder that we are sinners and in need of continual forgiveness. So that fire continually burning, the sacrifices continually being made, the burnt offering continually made every day, is a reminder we need continual forgiveness. That principle is carried over in the New Testament. The book of Hebrews again, chapter 7. The book of Hebrews and the 7th chapter, verse 25. Hence also, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So, on the priestly ministry of Christ, as it's developed there, he continually makes intercession for us because we have need of that continual forgiveness. If any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He's the propitiation for our sins. We need that continual cleansing. I've sinned today. I need the cleansing today. Well, that continual fire on the burnt offering was a constant reminder to all the Israelites. They constantly need God's forgiveness. It's also a reminder that God is a consuming fire. And that is one of the consistent metaphors for God in the Old Testament. Our God is a consuming fire. And you see his judgment in consuming the sacrifice. That he is a God who deals with sin. Look at some of these references. Back in Exodus chapter 24. We need to be reminded again and again that the character of God has not changed. And his attitude towards sin has not changed. And sin is no more acceptable today, 2,000 years after Christ, than it was 2,000 years before Christ. A holy God still views sin the same way as he did then. And so when we see him pictured as a consuming fire, a picture of his attitude towards sin and all unrighteousness that must come under his judgment. So even in Exodus chapter 24, verse 17, to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. It's a fearful sight. Over in Deuteronomy, chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and the 4th chapter. Verse 24. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. That's in the context of warning against false gods, graven images. Because God is a consuming fire. And if you would worship other gods, it would necessitate his judgment in consuming you. Chapter 9 of Deuteronomy. Verse 3. Know therefore today that it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them and subdue them before you. Talking about preparing the way for Israel into the promised land. He's a consuming fire. He'll go in judgment before you. The idea. Look over to the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah will be about 700 years after Moses. The character of God does not change. And so Isaiah chapter 30. And verse 27. Behold, the name of the Lord comes from a remote place. Burning is His anger, and dense is His smoke. His lips are filled with indignation, and His tongue is like a consuming fire. His breath is like an overflowing torrent, and so on. That picture, His tongue like a consuming fire. Burning is His anger. Dense is His smoke. Sin is a serious issue. God is a holy God. And that necessitates that sin be dealt with. One other passage, Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33. Verse 14. Sinners in Zion are terrified. Trembling has seized the godless. Who among us can live with the consuming fire? Who among us can live with continual burning? He who walks righteously and speaks with sincerity, and so on. You see what God is requiring there? He said, look out. If you are not righteous before God, you will be consumed by God. So that aspect of the character of God, I think it's significant that God required the fire to be continually burning on that altar so that His people be continually reminded that He's a consuming fire, so they not forget His attitude and His response to sin. Now, somewhere along the line today, we've forgotten that aspect of the character of God as God's children. Sin is no more acceptable, no more tolerable in the life of God's people today than it was in Israel 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. The grace of God manifested through the death of His Son, Jesus Christ, does not now mean that I can sin with impunity, that I need not fear any consequences. My understanding is that Old Testament saints had eternal security just like New Testament saints. The once saved, always saved. That did not change what God had to say about the manifestation of His character as regards sin for His people. It was done in a picture way that differs from what we have now. We don't have an altar with a burning fire any longer, but we need to be constantly reminded of God's righteousness, God's holiness, and God's demands on us as His people, lest we find ourselves bearing the brunt of His wrath, not to condemn us to hell, to bring the severe chastening of our holy and righteous Father upon rebellious children. Come back to Leviticus chapter 6. And you'll note something else here in verses 10 and 11. I found this very interesting. As read through what the instructions for the priest are here, still in the context of the burnt offering. One commentator noted these two facts. Verse 10. The priest is to put on his linen robe. He shall put on his undergarments next to his flesh. He shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. First thing to note here, even so menial a task as gathering the ashes from the altar had to be done by the officiating priest, properly dressed and attired for that ministry. It wasn't something you delegated to an assistant. But even removing the ashes that had been consumed, you dress like this to do it. Putting on the linen robe, the undergarments, and you remove those ashes and set them beside the altar. Then, verse 11, then he shall take off his garments and put on other garments and carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. Let me read you what this writer said. For removing the ashes, he had to put on different clothes than he wore in the holy place. There is always a dignity and an importance attached to the performance of the tasks which the Lord assigns to His servants, no matter how trivial the work may appear to be. The way in which one appears physically before God frequently betrays one's attitude of mind. Indifference and casual behavior are unacceptable when we are commanded to have our loins girded for service. however lowly that particular service might seem. Good reminder here. These details weren't recorded to bore Christians in the 20th century. They were recorded to remind Christians in the 20th century. Tendency to read them and say, ho-hum, but I read that and say, yeah, I go to all the trouble, get all dressed up in my fine linen garments just to clean the ashes off the altar. Come on, do that in my jeans. Then set them there right by the altar, get all changed into other clothes to carry the ashes outside the camp. Let's get serious. I got more to do than change clothes all day. What's so important about it? Had to be done exactly like God wanted it. It's a constant reminder of the importance of this task. You know what happens? Those lowly, mundane tasks degenerate to be just that. And I find myself plodding along. The priest had to be reminded every time. I'm not just cleaning ashes off, ho-hum. He had to get dressed in a special way to clean those ashes off. Reminded him of the importance of the task. I'm not just carrying old used ashes outside the camp. He had to change his clothes and get ready to carry those out. Reminder, what I'm doing is important. It's part of my service to God. I think we need reminded of that today. We as believers, we look at things that this is mundane. This is an insignificant task. What can be insignificant that a holy, almighty, all-sovereign God gives me to do? The importance of the task is not measured by what I'm doing. It's measured by who gave it to me to do. You know, if you give me a letter and say, hey, drop this off at so-and-so's house on your way home, I say, yeah, okay, it's a letter. The President of the United States says, Gil, would you drop this letter off for me? That's a letter. I mean, that's not a letter like you gave me. This is a letter. What made it important? The person who gave me the responsibility made it important. You know what makes the task? Not whether you clean so people can come study the Word. I mean, there's people cleaning buildings all over the world. Important thing is if you're doing it because God has given you that task to do. That's what makes it significant. Oh, I work in the nursery. I babysit. Who? There's millions of people babysitting all over the world. That in and of itself is not significant unless God's given you a task of taking care of little ones. Then that's significant. Cleaning ashes from the fireplace? People do that all the time. But this is the task God gave to be done. That made it important. That made it significant. That means there are no mundane tasks. They're all important. And our attitude ought to convey that. And our demeanor, the way we conduct ourselves, the way we go about it. I'm concerned, quite frankly, on the issue of dress. I read a good article. I almost brought it along, but I didn't want to get in trouble. I think sometimes that our whole demeanor manifests a rather casual indifference in our worship and service for Jesus Christ. I'm not saying that you ought to dress like you're rich. I'm saying that I ought to, in my whole demeanor of life, I'm serving the King of Kings. And I don't know that I ought to be doing it, I'll leave it there. I just think we need a little bit more care, a little bit more thought about the importance of what we're doing. Oh, I'm just going to church to study the Word. It doesn't matter. Whatever you do is okay. I mean, you're not going to focus on the externals, are you? Well, I want you to know God focuses a lot on the internals here. We're going to get there, but we got to move along. Verses 14 to 23, the grain offering. That was in Leviticus 2. Now there's some review here. The grain offering. In verse 16, what is left of it, Aaron and his sons are to eat. It shall be eaten as unleavened cakes in a holy place. So here this portion of the grain offering that went to the priest, you remember, they had to eat it within the confines of the temple. That's the holy place. So they couldn't take it and go off someplace else. Within the confines of the temple, they could eat it. That was true of the sin offering and the guilt offering as well. It had to be eaten within the confines of the temple, that outer court area. That helps you appreciate why there was that outer court. There were other things going to be done there, such as the priest eating their portion. Verse 20, this is the offering which Aaron and his sons are to present to the Lord on the day when he is anointed. The tenth of an ephah of fine flour is a regular grain offering, half of it in the morning, half of it in the evening. The high priest had to offer a grain offering every day for himself and the priesthood. That began on the day when he's anointed. That's the starting point. So when a priest was anointed, from that point on, daily, continually, he would offer a grain offering. And he wasn't allowed to eat of the offering that he himself made. So he could eat of the grain offering of the people of Israel when they brought it. But the grain offering that he offered, he was not allowed to eat of. That was totally offered to the Lord. The rest of the chapter, verses 24 to 30, deal with the sin offering. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 10, the trespass offering. And the sacrificial procedure is developed here a little more fully than it was earlier. Verses 7 to 10 mention the first four offerings and what the priest received from each. So verses 7 to 10 here review the first four offerings and what the priest was to get from each. And the priest received a portion of every sacrifice brought by a worshiper in Israel. From a hide on the burnt offering to a portion of the meat from the other offerings. The peace offering is mentioned in verses 11 to 21. As I mentioned, this is the only offering of which the lay people were allowed to partake. So they could keep a portion of this to eat themselves. And so this section here really gives the regulations for the sacrificial meal. The consuming of that portion of the sacrifice of the peace offering that they were allowed to eat. The participants could be the worshiper, his family, could be a Levite from his community, could be the poor in his community who couldn't afford to bring a peace offering of their own. They could be invited to share in this sacrifice as well. Deuteronomy chapter 12 gives further information on this sacrifice. We won't take time to turn there. Verse 21, when anyone touches anything unclean, whether human uncleanness, animal uncleanness, unclean detestable thing, and eats of the flesh of the sacrifice of peace offering which belong to the Lord, that person shall be cut off from his people. This whole issue of partaking in this fellowship meal, expressing fellowship with God and fellow believers, was taken very seriously. And if you didn't take it seriously, it resulted in your death. To be cut off usually refers to death in the Old Testament. Some say it would refer to excommunication for the nation here. That may be. The normal use of this expression refers to physical death and execution. The point either way is this is a serious matter. This meal is expressing a relationship with God and a relationship with God's people. And so it cannot be done lightly or with a person defiled. Reminder in verses 22 to 27, no fat or blood can be eaten. A reminder of that again. The fat, the choice portion, belongs to God. The blood is the life. That too belongs to God.